The tiny etched letters dead center of the door took Chartrand's breath away. Il Passetto. Chartrand stared. The Pope's secret escape route. Chartrand had certainly heard of Il Passetto, and he had even heard rumors that it had once had an entrance here in the library. But the tunnel hadn't been used in ages. Who could be banging on the other side? Chartrand took his flashlight and rapped on the door. There was a muffled exultation from the other side. The banging stopped, and the voices yelled louder. Chartrand could barely make out their words through the barricade. Kohler! Lie! Camerlengo! Who is that? Chartrand yelled. Langdon! Vittoria V... Chartrand understood enough to be confused. I thought you were dead. The door, the voices yelled. Open! Chartrand looked at the iron barrier and knew he would need dynamite to get through there. Impossible, he yelled. Too thick. Meeting, stop, Erlengo. Danger. Despite his training on the hazards of panic, Chartrand felt a sudden rush of fear at the last few words. Had he understood correctly? Heart pounding, he turned to run back to the office. As he turned, though, he stalled. His gaze had fallen to something on the door, something more shocking even than the message coming from beyond it. Emerging from the keyholes of each of the door's massive locks were keys. Chartrand stared. The keys were here. He blinked in disbelief. The keys to this door were supposed to be in a vault someplace. This passage was never used, not for centuries. Chartrand dropped his flashlight on the floor. He grabbed the first key and turned. The mechanism was rusted and stiff, but it still worked. Someone had opened it recently. Chartrand worked the next lock, and the next. When the last bolt slid aside, Chartrand pulled. The slab of iron creaked open. He grabbed his light and shone it into the passage. Robert Langdon and Vittoria Vetra looked like apparitions as they staggered into the library. Both were ragged and tired, but they were very much alive. "What is this?" Chartrand demanded. "What's going on? Where did you come from?" "Where's Max Kohler?" Langdon demanded. Chartrand pointed. "In a private meeting with the camera..." Langdon and Vittoria pushed past him and ran down the darkened hallway. Chartrand turned, instinctively raising his gun at their backs. He quickly lowered it and ran after them. Rocher apparently heard them coming, because as they arrived outside the Pope's office, Rocher had spread his legs in a protective stance and was leveling his gun at them. "Halt!" "The Camerlengo is in danger," Langdon yelled, raising his arms in surrender as he slid to a stop. "Open the door! Max Kohler is going to kill the Camerlengo!" Rocher looked angry. "Open the door," Vittoria said. "Hurry!" But it was too late. From inside the Pope's office came a blood-curdling scream. It was the Camerlengo. Chapter 114. The confrontation lasted only seconds. Camerlengo Ventresca was still screaming when Chartrand stepped past Rocher and blew open the door of the Pope's office. The guards dashed in. Langdon and Vittoria ran in behind them. The scene before them was staggering. The chamber was lit only by candlelight and a dying fire. Kohler was near the fireplace, standing awkwardly in front of his wheelchair. He brandished a pistol, aimed at the Camerlengo, who lay on the floor at his feet, writhing in agony. The Camerlengo's cassock was torn open, and his bare chest was seared black. Langdon couldn't make out the symbol from across the room, but a large square brand lay on the floor near Kohler. The metal still glowed red. Two of the Swiss guards acted without hesitation. They opened fire. The bullets smashed into Kohler's chest, driving him backward. Kohler collapsed onto his wheelchair, his chest gurgling blood. His gun went skittering across the floor. Langdon stood stunned in the doorway. Vittoria seemed paralyzed. "Max!" she whispered. The Camerlengo, still twisting on the floor, rolled toward Rocher, and with the trance-like terror of the early witch-hunts, pointed his index finger at Rocher and yelled a single word, "Illuminatus!"
"You bastard!" Rocher said, running at him. "You sanctimonious bast—"
This time it was Chartrand who reacted on instinct, putting three bullets in Rocher's back. The captain fell face first on the tile floor and slid lifeless through his own blood. Chartrand and the guards dashed immediately to the Camerlengo, who lay clutching himself, convulsing in pain. Both guards let out exclamations of horror when they saw the symbol seared on the Camerlengo's chest. The second guard saw the brand upside down and immediately staggered backward with fear in his eyes. Chartrand, looking equally overwhelmed by the symbol, pulled the Camerlengo's torn cassock up over the burn, shielding it from view. Langdon felt delirious as he moved across the room. Through a mist of insanity and violence, he tried to make sense of what he was seeing. A crippled scientist, in a final act of symbolic dominance, had flown into Vatican City and branded the church's highest officials.
"Some things are worth dying for," the Hashashin had said.
Langdon wondered how a handicapped man could possibly have overpowered the Camerlengo. Then again, Kohler had a gun.
It doesn't matter how he did it. Kohler accomplished his mission.
Langdon moved toward the gruesome scene. The Camerlengo was being attended, and Langdon felt himself drawn toward the smoking brand on the floor near Kohler's wheelchair.
The sixth brand?
The closer Langdon got, the more confused he became. The brand seemed to be a perfect square, quite large, and had obviously come from the sacred center compartment of the chest in the Illuminati lair. A sixth and final brand, the Hashashin had said, the most brilliant of all. Langdon knelt beside Kohler and reached for the object. The metal still radiated heat. Grasping the wooden handle, Langdon picked it up. He wasn't sure what he expected to see, but it most certainly was not this. Langdon stared a long, confused moment. Nothing was making sense. Why had the guards cried out in horror when they saw this? It was a square of meaningless squiggles. The most brilliant of all? It was symmetrical, Langdon could tell as he rotated it in his hand, but it was gibberish. When he felt a hand on his shoulder, Langdon looked up, expecting Vittoria. The hand, however, was covered with blood. It belonged to Maximilian Kohler, who was reaching out from his wheelchair. Langdon dropped the brand and staggered to his feet. Kohler's still alive! Slumped in his wheelchair, the dying director was still breathing, albeit barely, sucking in sputtering gasps. Kohler's eyes met Langdon's, and it was the same stony gaze that had greeted Langdon at CERN earlier that day. The eyes looked even harder in death, the loathing and enmity rising to the surface. The scientist's body quivered, and Langdon sensed he was trying to move. Everyone else in the room was focused on the Camerlengo, and Langdon wanted to call out, but he couldn't react. He was transfixed by the intensity radiating from Kohler in these final seconds of his life. The director, with tremulous effort, lifted his arm and pulled a small device off the arm of his wheelchair. It was the size of a matchbox. He held it out, quivering. For an instant, Langdon feared Kohler had a weapon, but it was something else.
"Give."
Kohler's final words were a gurgling whisper.
Give this to the media.
Kohler collapsed motionless, and the device fell in his lap. Shocked, Langdon stared at the device. It was electronic. The words Sony RUVI were printed across the front. Langdon recognized it as one of those new ultra-miniature palm-held camcorders. The balls on this guy, he thought. Kohler had apparently recorded some sort of final suicide message he wanted the media to broadcast. No doubt some sermon about the importance of science and the evils of religion. Langdon decided he had done enough for this man's cause tonight. Before Chartrand saw Kohler's camcorder, Langdon slipped it into his deepest jacket pocket. Kohler's final message can rot in hell. It was the voice of the Camerlengo that broke the silence. He was trying to sit up.
The cardinals, he gasped to Chartrand. Still in the Sistine Chapel, Chartrand exclaimed. Captain Rocher ordered, evacuate, now, everyone.
Chartrand sent one of the other guards running off to let the cardinals out. The Camerlengo grimaced in pain.
Helicopter, out front. Get me to a hospital.
Chapter 115. In St. Peter's Square, the Swiss guard pilot sat in the cockpit of the parked Vatican helicopter and rubbed his temples. The chaos in the square around him was so loud that it drowned out the sound of his idling rotors. This was no solemn candlelight vigil. He was amazed a riot hadn't broken out yet. With less than 25 minutes left until midnight, the people were still packed together, some praying, some weeping for the church, others screaming obscenities and proclaiming that this was what the church deserved, still others chanting apocalyptic Bible verses. The pilot's head pounded as the media lights glinted off his windshield. He squinted out at the clamorous masses. Banners waved over the crowd. Antimatter is the Antichrist. Scientist equals Satanist. Where is your God now? The pilot groaned, his headache worsening. He half considered grabbing the windshield's vinyl covering and putting it up so he wouldn't have to watch. But he knew he would be airborne in a matter of minutes. Lieutenant Chartrand had just radioed the terrible news. The Camerlengo had been attacked by Maximilian Kohler and seriously injured. Chartrand, the American, and the woman were carrying the Camerlengo out now so he could be evacuated to a hospital. The pilot felt personally responsible for the attack. He reprimanded himself for not acting on his gut. Earlier, when he had picked up Kohler at the airport, he had sensed something in the scientist's dead eyes. He couldn't place it, but he didn't like it. Not that it mattered. Rocher was running the show, and Rocher insisted this was the guy. Rocher had apparently been wrong. A new clamor arose from the crowd, and the pilot looked over to see a line of cardinals processing solemnly out of the Vatican onto St. Peter's Square. The cardinals' relief to be leaving Ground Zero seemed to be quickly overcome by looks of bewilderment at the spectacle now going on outside the church. The crowd noise intensified yet again. The pilot's head pounded. He needed an aspirin. Maybe three. He didn't like to fly on medication, but a few aspirin would certainly be less debilitating than this raging headache. He reached for the first aid kit, kept with assorted maps and manuals and a cargo box bolted between the two front seats. When he tried to open the box, though, he found it locked. He looked around for the key and then finally gave up. Tonight was clearly not his lucky night. He went back to massaging his temples. Inside the darkened basilica, Langdon, Vittoria, and the two guards strained breathlessly toward the main exit. Unable to find anything more suitable, the four of them were transporting the wounded Camerlengo on a narrow table, balancing the inert body between them as though on a stretcher. Outside the doors, the faint roar of human chaos was now audible. The Camerlengo teetered on the brink of unconsciousness. Time was running out. Chapter 116. It was 11:39 p.m. when Langdon stepped with the others from St. Peter's Basilica. The glare that hit his eyes was searing. The media lights shone off the white marble like sunlight off a snowy tundra. Langdon squinted, trying to find refuge behind the facade's enormous columns, but the light came from all directions. In front of him, a collage of massive video screens rose above the crowd. Standing there atop the magnificent stairs that spilled down to the piazza below, Langdon felt like a reluctant player on the world's biggest stage. Somewhere beyond the glaring lights, Langdon heard an idling helicopter and the roar of 100,000 voices. To their left, a procession of cardinals was now evacuating onto the square. They all stopped in apparent distress to see the scene now unfolding on the staircase.
"Careful now,"
Chartrand urged, sounding focused as the group began descending the stairs toward the helicopter. Langdon felt like they were moving underwater. His arms ached from the weight of the Camerlengo on the table. He wondered how the moment could get much less dignified. Then he saw the answer. The two BBC reporters had apparently been crossing the open square on their way back to the press area. But now, with the roar of the crowd, they had turned. Glick and Macri were now running back toward them. Macri's camera was raised and rolling. "Here come the vultures," Langdon thought. "Alt!" Chartrand yelled. "Get back!" But the reporters kept coming. Langdon guessed the other networks would take about 6 seconds to pick up this live BBC feed again. He was wrong. They took two. As if connected by some sort of universal consciousness, every last media screen in the piazza cut away from their countdown clocks and their Vatican experts and began transmitting the same picture, a jiggling action footage swooping up the Vatican stairs. Now, everywhere Langdon looked, he saw the Camerlengo's limp body in a technicolor close-up. "This is wrong," Langdon thought. He wanted to run down the stairs and interfere, but he couldn't. It wouldn't have helped anyway. Whether it was the roar of the crowd or the cool night air that caused it, Langdon would never know. But at that moment, the inconceivable occurred. Like a man awakening from a nightmare, the Camerlengo's eyes shot open and he sat bolt upright. Taken entirely by surprise, Langdon and the others fumbled with the shifting weight. The front of the table dipped. The Camerlengo began to slide. They tried to recover by setting the table down, but it was too late. The Camerlengo slid off the front. Incredibly, he didn't fall. His feet hit the marble, and he swayed upright. He stood a moment looking disoriented, and then, before anyone could stop him, he lurched forward, staggering down the stairs toward Macri. "No!" Langdon screamed. Chartrand rushed forward, trying to rein in the Camerlengo, but the Camerlengo turned on him, wild-eyed, crazed. "Leave me!" Chartrand jumped back. The scene went from bad to worse. The Camerlengo's torn cassock, having been only laid over his chest by Chartrand, began to slip lower. For a moment, Langdon thought the garment might hold, but that moment passed. The cassock let go, sliding off his shoulders down around his waist. The gasp that went up from the crowd seemed to travel around the globe and back in an instant. Cameras rolled, flash bulbs exploded. On media screens everywhere, the image of the Camerlengo's branded chest was projected, towering and in grisly detail. Some screens were even freezing the image and rotating it 180 degrees. The ultimate Illuminati victory. Langdon stared at the brand on the screens. Although it was the imprint of the square brand he had held earlier, the symbol now made sense. Perfect sense. The marking's awesome power hit Langdon like a train. Orientation. Langdon had forgotten the first rule of symbology. When is a square not a square? He had also forgotten that iron brands, just like rubber stamps, never looked like their imprints. They were in reverse. Langdon had been looking at the brand's negative. As the chaos grew, an old Illuminati quote echoed with new meaning. "A flawless diamond, born of the ancient elements, with such perfection that all those who saw it could only stare in wonder." Langdon knew now the myth was true. Earth, air, fire, water. The Illuminati diamond. Chapter 117. Robert Langdon had little doubt that the chaos and hysteria coursing through St. Peter's Square at this very instant exceeded anything Vatican Hill had ever witnessed. No battle, no crucifixion, no pilgrimage, no mystical vision, nothing in the shrine's 2,000-year history could possibly match the scope and drama of this very moment. As the tragedy unfolded, Langdon felt oddly separate, as if hovering there beside Vittoria at the top of the stairs. The action seemed to distend, as if in a time warp, all the insanity slowing to a crawl. the branded Camerlengo, raving for the world to see. The Illuminati diamond, unveiled in its diabolical genius. The countdown clock registering the final 20 minutes of Vatican history. The drama, however, had only just begun. The Camerlengo, as if in some sort of post-traumatic trance, seemed suddenly puissant, possessed by demons. He began babbling, whispering to unseen spirits, looking up at the sky and raising his arms to God. "Speak!" the Camerlengo yelled to the heavens. "Yes, I hear you!" In that moment, Langdon understood. His heart dropped like a rock. Vittoria apparently understood, too. She went white. "He's in shock," she said. "He's hallucinating. He thinks he's talking to God." "Somebody's got to stop this," Langdon thought. It was a wretched and embarrassing end. Get this man to a hospital. Below them on the stairs, Chinita Macri was poised and filming, apparently having located her ideal vantage point. The images she filmed appeared instantly across the square behind her on media screens, like endless drive-in movies all playing the same grisly tragedy. The whole scene felt epic. The Camerlengo, in his torn cassock, with a scorched brand on his chest, looked like some sort of battered champion who had overcome the rings of hell for this one moment of revelation. He bellowed to the heavens, "Ti sento Dio! I hear you, God!" Chartrand backed off, a look of awe on his face. The hush that fell across the crowd was instant and absolute. For a moment, it was as if the silence had fallen across the entire planet. Everyone in front of their TVs rigid, a communal holding of breath. The Camerlengo stood on the stairs before the world and held out his arms. He looked almost Christ-like, bare and wounded before the world. He raised his arms to the heavens and, looking up, exclaimed, "Grazie! Grazie Dio!" The silence of the masses never broke. "Grazie Dio!" the Camerlengo cried out again. Like the sun breaking through a stormy sky, a look of joy spread across his face. "Grazie Dio!" "Thank you, God?" Langdon stared in wonder. The Camerlengo was radiant now, his eerie transformation complete. He looked up at the sky, still nodding furiously. He shouted to the heavens, "Upon this rock I will build my church!" Langdon knew the words, but he had no idea why the Camerlengo could possibly be shouting them. The Camerlengo turned back to the crowd and bellowed again into the night, "Upon this rock I will build my church!" Then he raised his hands to the sky and laughed out loud. "Grazie Dio! Grazie!" The man had clearly gone mad. The world watched, spellbound. The culmination, however, was something no one expected. With a final joyous exultation, the Camerlengo turned and dashed back into St. Peter's Basilica. Chapter 118. 11:42 p.m. The frenzied convoy that plunged back into the basilica to retrieve the Camerlengo was not one Langdon had ever imagined he would be part of, much less leading. But he had been closest to the door and had acted on instinct. "He'll die in here," Langdon thought, sprinting over the threshold into the darkened void. "Camerlengo, stop!" The wall of blackness that hit Langdon was absolute. His pupils were contracted from the glare outside, and his field of vision now extended no farther than a few feet before his face. He skidded to a stop. Somewhere in the blackness ahead, he heard the Camerlengo's cassock rustle as the priest ran blindly into the abyss. Vittoria and the guards arrived immediately. Flashlights came on, but the lights were almost dead now, and didn't even begin to probe the depths of the basilica before them. The beams swept back and forth, revealing only columns and bare floor. The Camerlengo was nowhere to be seen.
"Camerlengo!" Chartrand yelled, fear in his voice. "Wait, signore!"
A commotion in the doorway behind them caused everyone to turn. Chinita Macri's large frame lurched through the entry. Her camera was shouldered, and the glowing red light on top revealed that it was still transmitting. Glick was running behind her, microphone in hand, yelling for her to slow down. Langdon could not believe these two. This is not the time. Out! Chartrand snapped. This is not for your eyes. But Macri and Glick kept coming.
Shanita! Glick sounded fearful now. This is suicide. I'm not coming.
Macri ignored him. She threw a switch on her camera. The spotlight on top glared to life, blinding everyone. Langdon shielded his face and turned away in pain.
Damn it!
When he looked up, though, the church around them was illuminated for 30 yards. At that moment, the Camerlengo's voice echoed somewhere in the distance.
Upon this rock, I will build my church.
Macri wheeled her camera toward the sound. Far off, in the grayness at the end of the spotlight's reach, black fabric billowed, revealing a familiar form running down the main aisle of the basilica. There was a fleeting instant of hesitation as everyone's eyes took in the bizarre image. Then the dam broke. Chartrand pushed past Langdon and sprinted after the Camerlengo. Langdon took off next, then the guards and Vittoria. Macri brought up the rear, lighting everyone's way and transmitting the sepulchral chase to the world. An unwilling Glick cursed aloud as he tagged along, fumbling through a terrified blow-by-blow commentary. The main aisle of St. Peter's Basilica, Lieutenant Chartrand had once figured out, was longer than an Olympic soccer field. Tonight, however, it felt like twice that. As the guards sprinted after the Camerlengo, he wondered where the man was headed. The Camerlengo was clearly in shock, delirious, no doubt, from his physical trauma and bearing witness to the horrific massacre in the Pope's office. Somewhere up ahead, beyond the reach of the BBC spotlight, the Camerlengo's voice rang out joyously.
Upon this rock I will build my church.
Chartrand knew the man was shouting scripture. Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, if Chartrand recalled correctly. Upon this rock I will build my church. It was an almost cruelly inapt inspiration. The church was about to be destroyed. Surely the Camerlengo had gone mad. Or had he? For a fleeting instant, Chartrand's soul fluttered. Holy visions and divine messages had always seemed like wishful delusions to him, the product of overzealous minds hearing what they wanted to hear. God did not interact directly. A moment later, though, as if the Holy Spirit himself had descended to persuade Chartrand of his power, Chartrand had a vision. 50 yards ahead, in the center of the church, a ghost appeared, a diaphanous, glowing outline. The pale shape was that of the half-naked Camerlengo. The specter seemed transparent, radiating light. Chartrand staggered to a stop, feeling a knot tighten in his chest.
The Camerlengo is glowing!
The body seemed to shine brighter now. Then it began to sink, deeper and deeper, until it disappeared, as if by magic, into the blackness of the floor. Langdon had seen the phantom also. For a moment he, too, thought he had witnessed a magical vision. But as he passed the stunned Chartrand and ran toward the spot where the Camerlengo had disappeared, he realized what had just happened. The Camerlengo had arrived at the niche of the palliums, the sunken chamber lit by 99 oil lamps. The lamps in the niche shone up from beneath, illuminating him like a ghost. Then, as the Camerlengo descended the stairs into the light, he had seemed to disappear beneath the floor. Langdon arrived breathless at the rim overlooking the sunken room. He peered down the stairs. At the bottom, lit by the golden glow of oil lamps, the Camerlengo dashed across the marble chamber toward the set of glass doors that led to the room holding the famous golden box.
"What is he doing?" Langdon wondered.
"Certainly he can't think the golden box." The Camerlengo yanked open the doors and ran inside. Oddly, though, he totally ignored the golden box, rushing right past it. 5 feet beyond the box, he dropped to his knees and began struggling to lift an iron grate embedded in the floor. Langdon watched in horror, now realizing where the Camerlengo was headed, Good God, no. He dashed down the stairs after him. Father, don't! As Langdon opened the glass doors and ran toward the Camerlengo, he saw the Camerlengo heave on the grate. The hinged iron bulkhead fell open with a deafening crash, revealing a narrow shaft and a steep stairway that dropped into nothingness. As the Camerlengo moved toward the hole, Langdon grabbed his bare shoulders and pulled him back. The man's skin was slippery with sweat, but Langdon held on. The Camerlengo wheeled, obviously startled. "What are you doing?" Langdon was surprised when their eyes met. The Camerlengo no longer had the glazed look of a man in a trance. His eyes were keen, glistening with a lucid determination. The brand on his chest looked excruciating. "Father," Langdon urged as calmly as possible, "you can't go down there. We need to evacuate." "My son," the Camerlengo said, his voice eerily sane, "I have just had a message. I know."
"Camerlengo!"
It was Chartrand and the others. They came dashing down the stairs into the room, lit by Macri's camera. When Chartrand saw the open grate in the floor, his eyes filled with dread. He crossed himself and shot Langdon a thankful look for having stopped the Camerlengo. Langdon understood, had read enough about Vatican architecture to know what lay beneath that grate. It was the most sacred place in all of Christendom. Terra Santa, holy ground. Some called it the necropolis. Some called it the catacombs. According to accounts from the select few clergy who had descended over the years, the necropolis was a dark maze of subterranean crypts that could swallow a visitor whole if he lost his way. It was not the kind of place through which they wanted to be chasing the Camerlengo.
"Signore," Chartrand pleaded, "you're in shock. We need to leave this place. You cannot go down there. It's suicide."
The Camerlengo seemed suddenly stoic. He reached out and put a quiet hand on Chartrand's shoulder.
"Thank you for your concern and service. I cannot tell you how. I cannot tell you I understand. But I have had a revelation. I know where the antimatter is."
Everyone stared. The Camerlengo turned to the group.
"Upon this rock I will build my church. That was the message. The meaning is clear."
Langdon was still unable to comprehend the Camerlengo's conviction that he had spoken to God, much less that he had deciphered the message. "Upon this rock I will build my church." They were the words spoken by Jesus when he chose Peter as his first apostle. What did they have to do with anything? Macri moved in for a closer shot. Glick was mute, as if shell-shocked. The Camerlengo spoke quickly now. "The Illuminati have placed their tool of destruction on the very cornerstone of this church, at the foundation." He motioned down the stairs. "On the very rock upon which this church was built. And I know where that rock is." Langdon was certain the time had come to overpower the Camerlengo and carry him off. As lucid as he seemed, the priest was talking nonsense. "A rock? The cornerstone and the foundation?" The stairway before them didn't lead to the foundation. It led to the necropolis.
"The quote is a metaphor, Father. There is no actual rock."
The Camerlengo looked strangely sad.
"There is a rock, my son."
He pointed into the hole.
"Pietro e la pietra."
Langdon froze. In an instant it all came clear. The austere simplicity of it gave him chills. As Langdon stood there with the others staring down the long staircase, he realized that there was indeed a rock buried in the darkness beneath this church.
"Pietro e la pietra."
Peter is the rock. Peter's faith in God was so steadfast that Jesus called Peter the rock, the unwavering disciple on whose shoulders Jesus would build his church. On this very location, Langdon realized, Vatican Hill, Peter had been crucified and buried. The early Christians built a small shrine over his tomb. As Christianity spread, the shrine got bigger, layer upon layer, culminating in this colossal basilica. The entire Catholic faith had been built, quite literally, upon St. Peter, the rock. The antimatter is on St. Peter's tomb, the Camerlengo said, his voice crystalline. Despite the seemingly supernatural origin of the information, Langdon sensed a stark logic in it. Placing the antimatter on St. Peter's tomb seemed painfully obvious now. The Illuminati, in an act of symbolic defiance, had located the antimatter at the core of Christendom, both literally and figuratively, the ultimate infiltration. "And if you all need worldly proof," the Camerlengo said, sounding impatient now, "I just found that grate unlocked." He pointed to the open bulkhead on the floor. "It is never unlocked. Someone has been down there. Recently." Everyone stared into the hole. An instant later, with deceptive agility, the Camerlengo spun, grabbed an oil lamp, and headed for the opening. Chapter 119. The stone steps declined steeply into the earth. "I'm going to die down here," Vittoria thought, gripping the heavy rope banister as she bounded down the cramped passageway behind the others. Although Langdon had made a move to stop the Camerlengo from entering the shaft, Chartrand had intervened, grabbing Langdon and holding on. Apparently the young guard was now convinced the Camerlengo knew what he was doing. After a brief scuffle, Langdon had freed himself and pursued the Camerlengo, with Chartrand close on his heels. Instinctively, Vittoria had dashed after them. Now she was racing headlong down a precipitous grade where any misplaced step could mean a deadly fall. Far below, she could see the golden glow of the Camerlengo's oil lamp. Behind her, Vittoria could hear the BBC reporters hurrying to keep up. The camera spotlight threw gnarled shadows beyond her down the shaft, illuminating Chartrand and Langdon. Vittoria could scarcely believe the world was bearing witness to this insanity. "Turn off the damn camera!" Then again, she knew the light was the only reason any of them could see where they were going. As the bizarre chase continued, Vittoria's thoughts whipped like a tempest. What could the Camerlengo possibly do down here? Even if he found the antimatter, there was no time. Vittoria was surprised to find her intuition now telling her the Camerlengo was probably right. Placing the antimatter 3 stories beneath the earth seemed an almost noble and merciful choice. Deep underground, much as in Z-Lab, an antimatter annihilation would be partially contained. There would be no heat blast, no flying shrapnel to injure onlookers, just a biblical opening of the earth and a towering basilica crumbling into a crater. Was this Kohler's one act of decency, sparing lives? Vittoria still couldn't fathom the director's involvement. She could accept his hatred of religion, but this awesome conspiracy seemed beyond him. Was Kohler's loathing really this profound? Destruction of the Vatican? Hiring an assassin? The murders of her father, the Pope, and 4 cardinals? It seemed unthinkable. And how had Kohler managed all this treachery within the Vatican walls? Rocher was Kohler's inside man, Vittoria told herself. Rocher was an Illuminatus. No doubt Captain Rocher had keys to everything. The Pope's chambers, Il Passetto, the necropolis, St. Peter's tomb, all of it. He could have placed the antimatter on St. Peter's tomb, a highly restricted locale, and then commanded his guards not to waste time searching the Vatican's restricted areas. Rocher knew nobody would ever find the canister. But Rocher never counted on the Camerlengo's message from above. The message. This was the leap of faith Vittoria was still struggling to accept. Had God actually communicated with the Camerlengo? Vittoria's gut said no, and yet hers was the science of entanglement physics, the study of interconnectedness. She witnessed miraculous communications every day. Twin sea turtle eggs separated and placed in labs thousands of miles apart, hatching at the same instant. Acres of jellyfish pulsating in perfect rhythm as if of a single mind. There are invisible lines of communication everywhere, she thought. But between God and man? Vittoria wished her father were there to give her faith. He had once explained divine communication to her in scientific terms, and he had made her believe. She still remembered the day she had seen him praying and asked him, "Father, why do you bother to pray? God cannot answer you." Leonardo Vetra had looked up from his meditations with a paternal smile. "My daughter, the skeptic, so you don't believe God speaks to man? Let me put it in your language." He took a model of the human brain down from a shelf and set it in front of her. "As you probably know, Vittoria, human beings normally use a very small percentage of their brain power. However, if you put them in emotionally charged situations, like physical trauma, extreme joy or fear, deep meditation, all of a sudden their neurons start firing like crazy, resulting in massively enhanced mental clarity."
"So what?"
Vittoria said. "Just because you think clearly doesn't mean you talk to God."
"Aha!" Victor exclaimed. "And yet remarkable solutions to seemingly impossible problems often occur in these moments of clarity. It's what gurus call higher consciousness. Biologists call it altered states. Psychologists call it supersentience." He paused. "And Christians call it answered prayer." Smiling broadly, he added, "Sometimes divine revelation simply means adjusting your brain to hear what your heart already knows." Now, as she dashed down headlong into the dark, Vittoria sensed perhaps her father was right. Was it so hard to believe that the Camerlengo's trauma had put his mind in a state where he had simply realized the antimatter's location? "Each of us is a god," Buddha had said. "Each of us knows all. We need only open our minds to hear our own wisdom." It was in that moment of clarity, as Vittoria plunged deeper into the earth, that she felt her own mind open, her own wisdom surface. She sensed now, without a doubt, what the Camerlengo's intentions were. Her awareness brought with it a fear like nothing she had ever known. "Camerlengo, no!" she shouted down the passage. "You don't understand!"
Vittoria pictured the multitudes of people surrounding Vatican City, and her blood ran cold.
"If you bring the antimatter up, everyone will die."
Langdon was leaping 3 steps at a time now, gaining ground. The passage was cramped, but he felt no claustrophobia. His once debilitating fear was overshadowed by a far deeper dread.
"Camerlengo!"
Langdon felt himself closing the gap on the lantern's glow. "You must leave the antimatter where it is. There's no other choice." Even as Langdon spoke the words, he could not believe them. Not only had he accepted the Camerlengo's divine revelation of the antimatter's location, but he was lobbying for the destruction of St. Peter's Basilica, one of the greatest architectural feats on earth, as well as of all the art inside. "But the people outside, it's the only way." It seemed a cruel irony that the only way to save the people now was to destroy the church. Langdon figured the Illuminati were amused by the symbolism. The air coming up from the bottom of the tunnel was cool and dank. Somewhere down here was the sacred necropolis, burial place of St. Peter and countless other early Christians. Langdon felt a chill, hoping this was not a suicide mission. Suddenly, the Camerlengo's lantern seemed to halt. Langdon closed on him fast. The end of the stairs loomed abruptly from out of the shadows. A wrought iron gate with 3 embossed skulls blocked the bottom of the stairs. The Camerlengo was there, pulling the gate open. Langdon leapt, pushing the gate shut, blocking the Camerlengo's way. The others came thundering down the stairs, everyone ghostly white in the BBC spotlight. Especially Glick, who was looking more pasty with every step. Chartrand grabbed Landon.
"Let the Camerlengo pass."
"No,"
Vittoria said from above, breathless.
"We must evacuate right now. You cannot take the antimatter out of here. If you bring it up, everyone outside will die."
The Camerlengo's voice was remarkably calm.
"All of you, we must trust. We have little time."
"You don't understand," Vittoria said. "An explosion at ground level will be much worse than one down here."
The Camerlengo looked at her, his green eyes resplendently sane.
"Who said anything about an explosion at ground level?"
Vittoria stared.
You're leaving it down here?
The Camerlengo's certitude was hypnotic.
There will be no more death tonight.
Father, but
please, some faith.
The Camerlengo's voice plunged to a compelling hush.
I am not asking anyone to join me. You are all free to go. All I am asking is that you not interfere with his bidding. Let me do what I have been called to do.
The Camerlengo's stare intensified.
I am to save this church, and I can. I swear on my life.
The silence that followed might as well have been thunder. Chapter 120. 11:51 p.m. Necropolis literally means City of the Dead. Nothing Robert Langdon had ever read about this place prepared him for the sight of it. The colossal subterranean hollow was filled with crumbling mausoleums, like small houses on the floor of a cave. The air smelled lifeless. An awkward grid of narrow walkways wound between the decaying memorials, most of which were fractured brick with marble platings. Like columns of dust, countless pillars of unexcavated earth rose up, supporting a dirt sky which hung low over the penumbral hamlet. City of the Dead, Langdon thought, feeling trapped between academic wonder and raw fear. He and the others dashed deeper down the winding passages.
Did I make the wrong choice?
Chartrand had been the first to fall under the Camerlengo's spell, yanking open the gate and declaring his faith in the Camerlengo. Glick and Macri, at the Camerlengo's suggestion, had nobly agreed to provide light to the quest. Although considering what accolades awaited them if they got out of here alive, their motivations were certainly suspect. Vittoria had been the least eager of all, and Langdon had seen in her eyes a wariness that looked, unsettlingly, a lot like female intuition.
It's too late now, he thought,
he and Vittoria dashing after the others.
We're committed.
Vittoria was silent, but Langdon knew they were thinking the same thing.
9 minutes is not enough time to get the hell out of Vatican City if the Camerlengo is wrong.
As they ran on through the mausoleums, Langdon felt his legs tiring, noting to his surprise that the group was ascending a steady incline. The explanation, when it dawned on him, sent shivers to his core. The topography beneath his feet was that of Christ's time. He was running up the original Vatican Hill. Langdon had heard Vatican scholars claim that St. Peter's tomb was near the top of Vatican Hill, and he had always wondered how they knew. Now he understood. The damn hill is still here. Langdon felt like he was running through the pages of history. Somewhere ahead was St. Peter's tomb, the Christian relic. It was hard to imagine that the original grave had been marked only with a modest shrine. Not anymore. As Peter's eminence spread, new shrines were built on top of the old, and now the homage stretched 440 feet overhead to the top of Michelangelo's dome, the apex positioned directly over the original tomb within a fraction of an inch. They continued ascending the sinuous passages. Langdon checked his watch. 8 minutes. He was beginning to wonder if he and Vittoria would be joining the deceased here permanently.
"Look out!" Glick yelled from behind them. "Snipe holes!"
Langdon saw them in time. A series of small holes riddled the paths before them. He leapt, just clearing them. Vittoria jumped too, barely avoiding the narrow hollows. She looked uneasy as they ran on.
Snake holes?
Snack holes, actually, Langdon corrected.
Trust me, you don't want to know.
The holes, he had just realized, were libation tubes. The early Christians had believed in the resurrection of the flesh, and they'd used the holes to literally feed the dead by pouring milk and honey into crypts beneath the floor. The Camerlengo felt weak. He dashed onward, his legs finding strength in his duty to God and man.
Almost there. He was in incredible pain.
The mind can bring so much more pain than the body. Still, he felt tired. He knew he had precious little time.
I will save your church, Father. I swear it.
Despite the BBC lights behind him, for which he was grateful, the Camerlengo carried his oil lamp high.
I am a beacon in the darkness. I am the light.
The lamp sloshed as he ran, and for an instant he feared the flammable oil might spill and burn him. He had experienced enough burned flesh for one evening. As he approached the top of the hill, he was drenched in sweat, barely able to breathe. But when he emerged over the crest, he felt reborn. He staggered onto the flat piece of earth where he had stood many times. Here the path ended. The necropolis came to an abrupt halt at a wall of earth. A tiny marker read, Mausoleum S. La tomba di San Pietro. Before him, at waist level, was an opening in the wall. There was no gilded plaque here, no fanfare, just a simple hole in the wall, beyond which lay a small grotto and a meager, crumbling sarcophagus. The Camerlengo gazed into the hole and smiled in exhaustion. He could hear the others coming up the hill behind him. He set down his oil lamp and knelt to pray.
Thank you, God. It is almost over.
Outside in the square, surrounded by astounded cardinals, Cardinal Mortati stared up at the media screen and watched the drama unfold in the crypt below. He no longer knew what to believe. Had the entire world just witnessed what he had seen? Had God truly spoken to the Camerlengo? Was the antimatter really going to appear on St. Peter's?
Look!
A gasp went up from the throngs.
There!
Everyone was suddenly pointing at the screen.
It's a miracle!
Mortati looked up. The camera angle was unsteady, but it was clear enough. The image was unforgettable. Filmed from behind, the Camerlengo was kneeling in prayer on the earthen floor. In front of him was a rough-hewn hole in the wall. Inside the hollow, among the rubble of ancient stone, was a terracotta casket. Although Mortati had seen the coffin only once in his life, he knew beyond a doubt what it contained.
San Pietro.
Mortati was not naive enough to think that the shouts of joy and amazement now thundering through the crowd were exultations from bearing witness to one of Christianity's most sacred relics. St. Peter's tomb was not what had people falling to their knees in spontaneous prayer and thanksgiving. It was the object on top of his tomb. The antimatter canister. It was there, where it had been all day, hiding in the darkness of the necropolis. Sleek, relentless, deadly. The Camerlengo's revelation was correct. Mortati stared in wonder at the transparent cylinder. The globule of liquid still hovered at its core. The grotto around the canister blinked red as the LED counted down into its final 5 minutes of life. Also sitting on the tomb, inches away from the canister, was the wireless Swiss Guard security camera that had been pointed at the canister and transmitting all along. Mortati crossed himself, certain this was the most frightful image he had seen in his entire life. He realized a moment later, however, that it was about to get worse. The Camerlengo stood suddenly. He grabbed the antimatter in his hands and wheeled toward the others. His face showed total focus. He pushed past the others and began descending the necropolis the way he had come, running down the hill. The camera caught Vittoria Vetra, frozen in terror.
"Where are you going? Camerlengo, I thought you said..."
"Have faith," he exclaimed as he ran off. Vittoria spun toward Langdon.
"What do we do?"
Robert Langdon tried to stop the Camerlengo, but Chartrand was running interference now, apparently trusting the Camerlengo's conviction. The picture coming from the BBC camera was like a roller coaster ride now, winding, twisting, fleeting freeze frames of confusion and terror as the chaotic cortege stumbled through the shadows back toward the necropolis entrance. Out on the square, Mortati let out a fearful gasp.
"Is she bringing that up here?"
On televisions all over the world, larger than life, The Camerlengo raced upward out of the necropolis with the antimatter before him.
There will be no more death tonight.
But the Camerlengo was wrong. Chapter 121. The Camerlengo erupted through the doors of St. Peter's Basilica at exactly 11:56 p.m. He staggered into the dazing glare of the world spotlight, carrying the antimatter before him like some sort of numinous offering. Through burning eyes, he could see his own form, half-naked and wounded, towering like a giant on the media screens around the square. The roar that went up from the crowd in St. Peter's Square was like none the Camerlengo had ever heard. Crying, screaming, chanting, praying, a mix of veneration and terror.
"Deliver us from evil," he whispered.
He felt totally depleted from his race out of the necropolis. It had almost ended in disaster. Robert Langdon and Vittoria Vetra had wanted to intercept him, to throw the canister back into its subterranean hiding place, to run outside for cover.
Blind fools!
The Camerlengo realized now with fearful clarity that on any other night he would never have won the race. Tonight, however, God again had been with him. Robert Langdon, on the verge of overtaking the Camerlengo, had been grabbed by Chartrand, ever trusting and dutiful to the Camerlengo's demands for faith. The reporters, of course, were spellbound and lugging too much equipment to interfere. The Lord works in mysterious ways. The Camerlengo could hear the others behind him now, see them on the screens, closing in. Mustering the last of his physical strength, he raised the antimatter high over his head. Then, throwing back his bare shoulders in an act of defiance to the Illuminati brand on his chest, he dashed down the stairs. There was one final act.
Godspeed, he thought. Godspeed.
4 minutes. Langdon could barely see as he burst out of the basilica. Again, the sea of media lights bored into his retinas. All he could make out was the murky outline of the Camerlengo directly ahead of him, running down the stairs. For an instant, refulgent in his halo of media lights, the Camerlengo looked celestial, like some kind of modern deity. His cassock was at his waist, like a shroud. His body was scarred and wounded by the hands of his enemies, and still he endured. The Camerlengo ran on, standing tall, calling out to the world to have faith, running toward the masses carrying this weapon of destruction. Langdon ran down the stairs after him.
What is he doing? He'll kill them all.
Satan's work, the Camerlengo screamed, has no place in the house of God. He ran on toward a now terrified crowd.
Father,
Langdon screamed behind him,
there's nowhere to go. Look to the heavens. We forget to look to the heavens.
In that moment, as Langdon saw where the Camerlengo was headed, the glorious truth came flooding all around him. Although Langdon couldn't see it on account of the lights, he knew their salvation was directly overhead. A star-filled Italian sky. The escape route. The helicopter the Camerlengo had summoned to take him to the hospital sat dead ahead, pilot already in the cockpit, blades already humming in neutral. As the Camerlengo ran toward it, Langdon felt a sudden, overwhelming exhilaration. The thoughts that tore through Langdon's mind came as a torrent. First, he pictured the wide-open expanse of the Mediterranean Sea. How far was it? 5 miles? 10? He knew the beach at Fiumicino was only about 7 minutes by train. But by helicopter, 200 miles an hour, no stops. If they could fly the canister far enough out to sea and drop it. There were other options, too, he realized, feeling almost weightless as he ran. La Cava Romana, the marble quarries north of the city, were less than 3 miles away. How large were they? 2 square miles? Certainly they were deserted at this hour. Dropping the canister there...
Everyone back,
the Camerlengo yelled. His chest ached as he ran.
Get away, now!
The Swiss guards standing around the chopper stood slack-jawed as the Camerlengo approached them.
Back!
The priest screamed. The guards moved back. With the entire world watching in wonder, the Camerlengo ran around the chopper to the pilot's door and yanked it open. out some, now! The guard jumped out. The Kammerlinger looked at the high cockpit seat and knew that in his exhausted state he would need both hands to pull himself up. He turned to the pilot, trembling beside him, and thrust the canister into his hands.
Hold this. Hand it back when I'm in.